I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of the podcast author or individuals participating in the podcast and do not represent those of iHeartMedia, Tenderfoot TV, or their employees. This podcast also contains subject matter which may not be suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised.
We saw two young girls walking along the street, and he said, "Do you want to earn 150,000 Belgian francs?" And I said, "Sure, but how?" And then he said, "We had to kidnap the girls first, and then he'd show me."
These are the words of Claude Thiroux, describing a conversation with Marc Dutroux just after his release from prison.
And I said, "Listen, I don't go around kidnapping young girls." And he said, "Look, it's easy. You grab them from behind the neck with one arm, and cover their mouths, then you just throw them in the back of the van. And you can knock them out if you need to." I said, "No way. I'm not going to do that." And after he dropped me off at home, I immediately called the police and reported it. When I found out about the disappearance of Julie and Melissa, I suspected that Marc was involved, and I went back to the police. It's too bad they didn't listen to me.
Is somebody who understands emotions.
And I told them it is very exceptional that somebody abducts two children at the same time.
It would have been the end of it in 1986. But my God, it was just the beginning.
I think Belgium was a paradise for perverts in those days.
Welcome to Le Monstre. I'm your host, Matt Graves. The release of Marc Dutroux after his first prison sentence marked the beginning of a new wave of depravity that would change this country forever. It began on the 8th of April, 1992, the day Dutroux was released from prison for good behavior after serving less than half his sentence for 13 and a half years. His wife, Michelle Martin, marked the day in bold in her journal with just one word: freedom. Despite having later claimed that she was manipulated, Michelle was certainly excited to jump back into life with Dutroux. She had meticulously planned his release, and their first stop was to see a doctor who granted them with disability status. This allowed them to claim benefits of 80,000 Belgian francs a month, above the average salary in Belgium at the time. Always thinking ahead, Dutroux got the doctor to prescribe him powerful tranquilizers, Haldol and Rohypnol. Rohypnol is roughly 10 times stronger than Valium and has come to be known as the date rape drug, often referred to as roofies on the street. So the state granted a psychopath convicted of raping children with early release, a free salary, and a steady supply of roofies and sent him on his way.
He was really a master manipulator. I mean, here is a guy who is a known criminal, who's been convicted of raping and kidnapping children, and he somehow gets out of prison early and gets the state to pay him a pension. On top of that, they give him the kind of drugs used to rape people. It's crazy. I mean, what on earth were they thinking?
As soon as November 1992, 8 months after being released from prison, the police were called to an ice skating rink where Dutroux was accused of molesting a girl. Nothing came out of it, and Dutroux wasn't arrested. In September of 93, a man Dutroux had met while in prison reported that he tried to convince him to help him abduct a young girl, but this wasn't followed up either. Then, in 1994, Dutroux and his wife welcomed an 18-year-old girl from Slovakia who wanted to spend the summer in Belgium. He slipped her some roofies and then raped her at home. She didn't even know it happened until it later turned up on a video cassette seized at one of Dutroux's properties. Apart from his sexual crimes, Dutroux dove right back into stealing for a living as well. In 1994 and 95, Dutroux started working with another criminal from France named Bernard Weinstein. Weinstein had recently moved to Belgium from France, where he had spent 9 years in prison for theft and armed robbery. He and Dutroux worked together on various criminal enterprises, mostly involving a vehicle theft ring. Dutroux's crimes with Weinstein bring us to 1995, where this series started. Over the next 14 months, Dutroux and his accomplices would abduct six young girls whose names we should never forget. Julie Lejeune, Melissa Rousseau, Anne Marshall, Effia Lambrex, Sabine Dardenne, and Letitia Deleuze. Despite the warning signs, his criminal past, and reports that Dutroux might be responsible for the abductions, authorities failed to ever even question him. It wasn't until August of 1996, weeks after Letitia Deleuze was abducted, that Dutroux would be arrested. A witness came forward to identify the license plate of his van, seen near where Letitia had disappeared. Eventually, he would admit to abducting Sabine and Letitia, and he led police to his dungeon in Charleroi, where the girls were found alive. You'll recall from episode 4 that I interviewed a police officer named Michel Demoulin, who got Dutroux to admit to the kidnapping of Letitia Deleuze and took him to the secret dungeon from where Letitia and Sabine Dardenne were rescued. After discovering the scale of Dutroux's activities, police strongly started to suspect his involvement with the disappearance of Julie and Melissa in 1995. Demoulin continued to interrogate Dutroux about this after the discovery of Letitia and Sabine. Here are his words from an interview read by an interpreter.
Marc Dutroux said that he kidnapped Letitia because Sabine wanted a friend. She wanted me to bring her Julie Lejeune. And I thought, wait a minute, Julie Lejeune? I was convinced he made a Freudian slip. Julie Lejeune had gone missing way before Sabine was kidnapped. I knew at this point that we were onto something. So then, I really started to squeeze him about Julie and Melissa. After a lot of back and forth, he admitted that Julie and Melissa had been in the dungeon, but that someone else had brought them there.
2 days after taking police to where Sabine and Letitia had been locked away, Dutroux cracked again on August 17th, 1996. He said that his friends Bernard Weinstein and Michel Lelievre had kidnapped Julie and Melissa and brought them to him. He said that they were at one of his properties in a town called Sars-la-Buissière and agreed again to take police there. The excitement of finding Sabine and Letitia 2 days earlier had given the families of Julie and Melissa hope. After 14 months of the worst kind of fear and anxiety, they learned that Dutroux may have been involved with the disappearances of their beloved girls. The fathers of Julie and Melissa wasted no time in heading to Charleroi to speak with locals and distribute flyers. In interviews with the news media at the time, you could feel a sense of hope in their voices. This is the voice of Gino Rousseau, the father of Melissa.
Knowing that Sabine and Letitia were found, I came to deliver 3,000 flyers. We've never lost hope, but everything we've said since the disappearance of Julie and Melissa, and by that I mean the hypothesis of pedophilia and sexual kidnapping, if I can say that way, ended up being true, so we still have hope. But we are frustrated because it's been 14 months. But in a way, We're happy to see that everything we've done for Julie and Melissa has helped other children.
And this is Jean-Denis Lejeune, the father of Julie, from the same interview.
It's wonderful for the two families to be able to get their children back. It's a feeling we'd like to be able to taste as well. We couldn't sleep last night because we're thinking that if Dutroux says something that could help us find Julie and Melissa, we don't want to miss anything.
Do you think there could be a connection between these two cases?
We think so. In any case, we hope so because it could be the end of the threat we've been looking for 14 months. And if we could find the end of that threat, even if the girls aren't in Charleroi, but somewhere else, if they came through here, it would at least be a trace. It's what we hope in any case.
It's hard to imagine actually hoping that your child was in the clutches of a man who was just arrested for kidnapping girls and locking them away in a dungeon. Such was the desperation of these families. It could mean their girls were alive, certainly damaged, but at least alive.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The entire nation had gotten to know these families through their relentless campaign to find their missing girls. Most all of us living in Belgium at the time were familiar with the faces of these two cute little girls, Julie and Melissa. Everyone was on edge as news spread about the search happening in the town of Sars-la-Buissière. Douglas de Koninck, who we heard from in episode 2, is an investigative journalist who covered this case closely from the start. He described what it was like to be caught up in the whirlwind news cycle from the time that Dutroux was arrested and Sabine and Letitia were rescued to when the search for Julie and Melissa in Sars-la-Buissière started.
So here we were, the 15th of August, 1996. I just came back from holiday with my colleague, and I was the news chief on this Thursday. So on Wednesday evening, I remember I got a phone call from my colleague, Walter de Bock. But he said that something might happen with this Letizia case in Bertrie. She had vanished a few days before, and they just gave me the hint, be alert for something happening with this Letizia case. We had no idea where to start, where to begin. I just remember this Thursday evening must have been around 8 o'clock. There was a news wire on Belgrade, the agency, saying Letizia and Sabine found alive, press conference, Inshallah, within an hour or so, this was the calmest day at work you could ever imagine. Turned into the most crazy one ever. We immediately sent a reporter to Charleroi. We started doing phone calls to the police. We have to change the cover of the newspaper. It was a crazy evening, and we've been working long past midnight, I guess. And then came the next day. It was Friday when Belgium woke up with images of Sabine and Letizia getting out of this cage, welcomed by hundreds of people. I remember the bonfire in Bertried, because there had been copies of A4 with her face on it. They had thousands, tens of thousands. The whole region was full of these papers. They decided to recollect all these photos of Letizia missing, and to put them on a big bonfire, and that was the biggest party they ever had in Bertrie. So for us journalists, on this Friday, we still were in a very small team. We started getting information about Marc Dutroux. We started getting information about Michel Martin. We think we made a special edition of 20 pages. We have been working like hell this very first day of the Dutroux affair. And we ended up in a pizzeria around, I think, 8 or 9 in the evening with some colleagues. We just found that we deserved a good meal and a good few bottles of good wine. It was really, we thought it was the end of a joyful moment in our careers, witnessing the liberation of these two girls, seeing people dancing in the streets. Yeah, and then I think just before the pizza arrived, there was the first mobile phone ringing. And then the second, and in those days you had these beepers, and every journalist heard the beep and just a few words saying, digging in Salle La Bruissière. And I think from the very first seconds the word digging, we knew that Marc Dutroux had a second house in Salle La Bruissière. Yeah, from that moment on, the story being so joyful turned into a real nightmare. So we didn't finish our pizza. I think some ate their pizzas in their cars. We all drove to Salle La Bruissière, very difficult to find, but there was no GPS in those days. I just remember standing there in front of the little church of the very... Salle La Bruissière is really the smallest village you can imagine. And this whole village was one... Yeah, it was filled with all these big cars, trucks, police cars, of course. And we were there, I think we were like 15, 20 journalists. We all knew exactly what was happening, but who was going to say it? And I remember this great friend and reporter of the Flemish radio station was there really trembling, and he said, I have to do a comment in the midnight news on the radio. Am I going to say that they are looking here for Julie and Melissa? Can I be the first to pronounce these words?
Douglas and his colleagues spent a long night in Salle La Bruissière, and by the next morning, more media had flooded the scene around the search site, and everyone waited in hope and fear. This is a news report from that day.
We are here just a few meters from Dutroux's house. Since early this morning, there's a certain effervescence here. The gendarmerie has sealed off the perimeter by a few hundred meters to keep back onlookers. We can't imagine the worst. We don't dare to pronounce the names of the girls who've been missing for several months. The gendarmes are quite calm, and they're not letting any information filter out. Everyone's waiting for a sign or a gesture that could announce the fatality or the climax of one or the other cases.
The entire nation was glued to their television sets, hoping for the miracle rescue of Sabine and Letitia to repeat itself for Julie and Melissa. At one point, everything at the search site stopped, and search and excavation teams halted their activities. At 6:30 p.m. on August 17th, 1996, the bodies of Julie and Melissa were discovered at Dutroux's property in Salle La Bruissière. They were found buried deep in the ground, with their bodies tightly tied up. It was the most horrific outcome imaginable, and the cruelest conclusion of 14 months of pain and suffering for the families.
The accusations against Marc Dutroux include kidnap, rape, and murder. His victims were children. At one of Dutroux's homes, police found him digging out his basement, but thought nothing of it. By his own later admission, he was building a prison to keep kidnapped children. By the time the police found out, it was too late. The girls were already dead. Patricia Kelly, CNN Brussels.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turned sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, I'm driving down the E40 towards Liège from Brussels. And I'm on my way to meet with Karine Rousseau, who is the mother of one of the victims, Melissa Rousseau, who was abducted along with Julie Lejeune in 1995. And I'm actually quite nervous about this. Karine Rousseau is an incredible woman. She doesn't really like to talk to journalists anymore, but after about a year of trying, I finally somehow got her to agree to meet with me. And I don't blame her. I mean, for the last 26 years, her life has been very difficult. Not only did she lose her child, but she was lied to by the police and mistreated by the judiciary. And then, of course, the whole media circus that followed and, to a certain extent, still follows her today. Anyway, I don't want to just drag her through all of the painful memories. I really want to ask her about some of the loose ends. And of course, I won't be the first to look into that, but there's some questions that still really need to be answered here. Okay, here I am pulling off the bridge, arriving in Grasse-Olonia, near Liège. And I'm driving
by this godforsaken bridge where the girls disappeared. 25, almost 26 years ago, I guess.
Karine and Gino Rousseau are now two of the most recognized faces in Belgium. They never wanted it to be this way. Belgium is actually quite a separated country. The Flemish-speaking region in the north, called Flanders, and the French-speaking region in the south, called Wallonia, are very different. Honestly speaking, they don't always get along very well. The families of Anne and Effie from Flanders and Julie and Melissa from Wallonia had created a bond that resonated with the entire country. Their very public struggle captured the hearts and minds of normal Belgians in a way that's hard to explain. The moment that Julie and Melissa's bodies were discovered is far from the end of this story. What follows strains the limits of believability. I wanted to meet with Karine Rousseau and ask her about some things that still don't sit right with me to this day.
Bonjour, bonjour. Ça va? Enchanté.
She welcomed me warmly into her house. It was an unseasonably hot day, and Gino was mowing the lawn, which you can hear in the background. Luckily, he finished up before I sat down with Karine to talk. You will, however, hear a lot of background noise as we sat outside, and that infamous bridge over the highway is not very far off in the distance. Karine looked great. It was heartening to see her smile. You have to remember that we all got to know her on television in the middle of the worst circumstances imaginable. The footage of her in the hastily organized press conference after the discovery of Julie and Melissa's body is the purest physical embodiment of suffering I think I've ever seen. She speaks extremely well with a distinguishable twang of Liège accent, which she says she doesn't like, but I find charming. I'm relieved that the atmosphere is comfortable and that she seems relaxed.
1, 2, 3.
Very good.
I'd like to share something from an incredible book she published in 2016 called 14 Months. It's a collection of diary entries she made during the 14 months between when Melissa disappeared and her body was found. I asked Karine if she might be willing to read a powerful passage from this book, and she agreed. She wrote it on December 27th, 1995. 8 months before learning of the death of her beautiful child, Melissa.
Melissa, Mimi, ma petite fille, je t'appelle.
Melissa, Mimi, my little girl. I call you in the empty house just to hear my voice resonate with your name like before, and to hope for a tenth of a second that you'll answer. But alas, I only hit a wall of silence. This silence that is driving me crazy, that wraps me up and thickens. This silence that is drowning me. Silence of your absence, silence of your disappearance, silence of the legal system, silence of the powerful, scandalous silence, accomplice of crime and misfortune. I could never stand the silences, the things unsaid. Do you remember? I could never stand to let any silence come between us, between your father and me, between your brother and you, between any of you and me. I've always been a breaker of silence, no matter what the price, even if it hurt. For me, silence is the beginning of the end, a harbinger of death, the opposite of life. Never could I stand silence.
Jamais je ne pouvais supporter le silence.
This was written on a cold December night, 6 months after the disappearance of Melissa. The silence Karine wrote about then was not only about missing a rambunctious little girl running around the house. It was about the intolerable silence of police and the judiciary. Was this silence just the normal course of action for a case that had gone cold? Or could it be something much more sinister? It's hard to imagine that police might have had an idea of who kidnapped Julie and Melissa, but never asked for a warrant or made any effort to make an arrest. But if they did know and did nothing, why? Who are they trying to protect? It sounds like a conspiracy theory born from the frustration of embittered parents and a community fed up with law enforcement's lack of progress. And many people today insist that's exactly what it is. Nothing more than baseless accusations. But sometimes, conspiracies are more than theory and need to be put to the test. Meanwhile, back at the crime scene in Sars-la-Buissière, where Julie and Melissa's bodies were found, police made another shocking discovery. Approximately 2 hours after finding the girls' bodies, the excavation team found another body. The corpse was that of a middle-aged white male showing signs of torture. An autopsy confirmed that this man had been drugged and tortured, but the final cause of death was asphyxiation after having been buried alive. What they didn't know at the time was that there was a link between this corpse and the two teenage girls, Anne Marshall and Effie Lambrechts, who'd gone missing over a year earlier from the Belgian seaside. Next time on Le Monstre. As people began to learn about Dutroux's previous crimes of child abduction and rape and his early release from prison, anger starts shifting towards the judicial system.
Public outrage at the catalogue of atrocities attributed to this man has escalated into nationwide anger at the system which allowed Dutroux and his accomplices to operate, unchecked and at will, for years. Belgian justice is on trial.
The country is on the brink of revolution as citizens take to the streets in protest.
It brought to the surface all the frustration of the population. And I remember when I walked into the streets and we did the Marche Blanche. So it was like a huge national gathering where everyone and all the souls of Belgians, being from Brussels or being from Wallonia or from Flanders, even though we speak different languages, we were all in that together.
Le Monstre is a production of Tenderfoot TV and iHeartRadio, hosted and executive produced by me, Matt Graves, produced by Thomas Resimont of Bubble Sound. Donald Albright and Payne Lindsay are executive producers on the behalf of Tenderfoot TV, with producer Makeup and Vanity Set. Matt Frederick and Alex Williams are executive producers on the behalf of iHeartRadio, with producer Trevor Young. Original music by Jay Ragsdale. Sound design by Cooper Skinner and Thomas Resimont. Mixed and mastered by Cooper Skinner. Cover design by Trevor Eiler. Le Monstre includes archival audio from Sonuma, RTBF Archives, and CNN Archives. Special thanks to Beck Media and Marketing, Station 16, Jeanne Savigna, and the teams at iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV. Find us on social media at monster_pod. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio or Tenderfoot TV, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold-Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.